Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price. This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax Live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.
Welcome, dear listeners. I'm Jonathan Carlin.
And I'm Benjamin Carlin.
And we invite you to join us through the Gryffindor, your one-way ticket to the enchanting world of Harry Potter. So grab your wands and dust off your broomsticks and join us as we unlock the mysteries behind Prisoner of Azkaban, Chapter 5, The Dementor, live in Roanoke, but not really live.
we're back in
just
studio.
Back in studio.
That's okay, though. That's okay.
That's okay, Anna. We'll be here for a while, but not forever.
Not forever, because Tor 2.0, or Tor West Coast, is now upon us.
It is on sale.
It's on sale.
It's on sale, yeah. If you haven't heard, if you missed it, we're coming to the West Coast with Through the Gryffindor this September. We're going to be hitting Seattle, Portland, Sacramento, Berkeley, San Diego, and Los Angeles.
Yes, it's going to start. Everything will kick off in Seattle on September 21st and run through September 29th. So it should be another amazing leg. And it's going to be so much fun because we are going to be hitting the like final chapters of Prisoner of Azkaban while we're on the West Coast tour.
So yes.
They're going to be some super juicy, super action packed.
Yes.
Big meaty chapters that we're going to be able to dissect.
I'm so excited about it. Especially, we were just sort of looking ahead at the chapters. If you are in San Diego, that is, Hermione's Big Secret? That's the chapter there?
Yes.
That is the longest chapter we've had to date. It is like all of the Time Turner stuff. So, just saying, you're not going to want to miss it.
Yeah, it's going to be so much fun. And honestly, I can't stress it enough. Going out on the East Coast, it was so much fun.
Yeah.
It was so cool to get to be in the room with everybody. There were moments I think I said it before, but you'd be reading along or you'd be making a comment. You could see little heads nodding off in the distance and you're like, oh my gosh, people know exactly where I'm going with this, or the occasional collective gasp, certainly some laughter.
Yeah.
It's all so much fun. And there's exclusive merch that's also available
while
we're on tour.
Also, yes, exclusive merch and meet and greets and all that. And then we'll also do a live Jay versus Ben as part of the show as well.
Yes, indeed.
So all that's fun. It's going to be great to be in the same room as you guys, but what it's not fun to be in the same room as, Ben, is a Dementor.
Yes, which is going to be the primary subject of Chapter 5 here in Prisoner of Azkaban. It is also our chapter art.
It is. We get a look at the Dementor as well.
You know what's really interesting about Dementors is that they have hands.
I know. Yeah, they do.
Because
they have hands and they have mouths.
Yeah, it seems odd to me. Because I think if you go into Fantastic Beasts, the book, aren't Dementors supposed to be descended or created or some cousin of Lethifolds?
There is something about that in there. I don't know. I did not look that up before this particular chapter. I do remember something to that effect. And it's sort of they're a classification that's not mortal or immortal. They are amortal.
Okay,
which is it's sort of Peeves the Poltergeist. He was not born and he cannot be killed, but he could just sort of dissipate. Like Peeves is the manifestation of all of the rule breaking in the castle.
Yes.
And Dementors kind of exist in the same realm. They are the manifestation of despair and depression and suffering.
Right. So the more of that is existing out in the world, sort of as we'll see going into Half-Blood Prince era.
Yeah.
Is the Dementors are starting to breed, they're appearing or manifesting out of seemingly nowhere. But that's what's always so strange to me, because the cloakedness of them almost makes me think of just sort of a black, shadowy figure of sorts, like almost as if it's like it's there but it's not there, but yeah, like, you know, like it's almost ethereal.
Right, it's surprising to me that they have like a physical thing you can touch, but I guess at the same rate, like Peeves can like pick stuff up.
That's true.
And like throw things.
Like Peeves can interact. Yeah. Pretty thoroughly.
He just feels more like a ghost in a way that like a Dementor doesn't. Like it feels like a Dementor cannot like pass through a wall or something.
No. Yeah. It does, but it does seem like Peeves can do that.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
So like they are like a solid creature, but they cannot be killed, and they cannot be like I guess it says they breed. But I guess that just sort of means they're like spreading. They're sort of like a virus almost.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, like the more of them there are, the more despair there is, and the more despair there is, the more Dementors get created.
Yeah, I don't think there's a world where Dementors are like, you know, having like a prom. You know, it's like
Can
you imagine like a Dementor doing like a little promposal for you know, like another Dementor, and it's like, hey, you want to hang? Have little Dementors one day.
Yeah, Dementoids. There's nothing romantic or lovey-dovey about a Dementor.
No,
at all.
None whatsoever.
None whatsoever. I think like even the way they're depicted is like almost interesting because they look like the classic depiction of like death.
Yeah, like a little bit of like a Grim Reaper.
Yeah, type. Yeah, of like the Grim Reaper. Like if they're holding a scythe, you'd be like, yeah, that's just death.
Yeah, absolutely. Which I mean, I guess is not, I don't know, terribly far. They are like very, they are so very unusual in their unique ability to like remove one's soul while also like not having that soul be like inside of them. Like, you know, it's not like they like possess the soul for like later usage. It's not like you can get the soul back.
Yeah.
So strangely dangerous creatures that we finally get to refer to, you know, officially
by their real names. So this has been like, I've thought before, like, could there be like a way, like, or like ways for like, I don't know. I thought once upon a time we could make a video like, you know, ways Voldemort could still come back or something, which I don't really think there are great ways for it. But like, if you had someone like Barty Crouch Jr. who eventually like loses his soul, like if Voldemort had like put a soul inside of that body as like a Horcrux, he would just like be back to life, right? He would like be able to walk around and just sort of like be Voldemort then.
I sort of think,
you know?
So.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, because then there'd be like the only piece of soul left in Barty Crouch Jr. would be Voldemort's.
Right.
And it's already like a living body. So it would have some kind of like impulses again.
Right.
You know, to do things. So I sort of think so. But after all of his, you know, pieces of soul had been destroyed, there would be no soul left to be placed.
Right. Yeah.
In there.
There's
so
nothing left to put in
like,
there.
You know, at that point it would just be like more of like a Nagini type situation where Neville would have to cut off Barty Crouch Jr.'s head.
Exactly.
I think if so facto,
then gone.
Then gone.
That'd have been a great scene too. You know, just Neville going full decapitation.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's for the Game of Thrones version of the tale. It's like, oh, I see what we've gone. Okay, we've gone heavy.
Oh, we've gone big. Yeah. All right. That would have been such an interesting like plot twist, Deathly Hallows, if it's just like, and Barty Crouch Jr. was back.
Oh my gosh. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I mean, like, who's that? David Tennant? Is that
David Tennant? Yeah, yes.
Like they went for some like pretty big casting.
Yes.
To not use them.
Yeah, he's like
more.
Barely in the movie.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Just very barely. So that, I wonder if that was a situation where he was like, can I be involved? I want to do something.
Yeah.
And they're
yeah.
like, yeah. It's David Tennant. Yes,
of course.
You can be involved.
We'll put you in the trailers.
Right, yeah, yeah, yeah. People will be so excited to see you, and then they'll be kind of disappointed they don't see that much of you.
Yeah, but you can do like the exposition dump at the end.
Right. How do you feel about kind of having like a tongue nervous twitch maneuver?
Yes, it'll make it super obvious who the bad guy is in a way that was not obvious in the books.
Yes, yes.
All right.
Anyway.
Well, okay, we're getting very ahead of ourselves and haven't even gotten to the first sentence, which I do want to talk about.
Oh,
the first sentence is, Tom woke Harry the next morning with his usual toothless grin and a cup of tea, to which I'm like, is Tom in the room?
I think he is.
You're like, why are you in the room? I cannot, if I was at a hotel and the people working at the hotel came in to wake me up, I'd be like, whoa, 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 no tip, no tip.
I am not comfy.
This is
the way this is played out.
Cross the line, Tom.
Yep. Yeah. Harry's like, wah! I could just just imagine that wake up call.
Yep. Harry doesn't seem bothered by it, but whatever.
At least there's tea.
Yeah, I guess he brought tea, right? Green with a cup of tea. Also, I guess he must have already made it to Ron's room, because before Harry can even get dressed, Ron is bursting in and Percy's all mad at him for dripping tea on his photo of Penelope Clearwater, which I just love the idea that Ron was just like sort of up early, having a nice calm cup of tea alone in the room before Percy woke up. And then Percy wakes up and is like, Ron!
Yes, yes.
What is this?
What has happened here? What I think is funny about that is it says that apparently the blotch of water that fell on the photo has like smudged her nose.
Yeah.
So this is like one of those like wizard photo problems,
yeah,
I guess. So now the photo of Penelope is hiding at the bottom of the frame because her nose has gone blotchy.
Does that mean like the blotch moves around with
her? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm like, I don't know if that's how I think that would work.
But I know.
I'm fine with it for comedic purposes.
Absolutely.
But you know, it's like, is that how that would go down? The other thing that I think is kind of interesting about this and this chapter in general, really in everything we've heard about Percy so far, is that like it kind of feels like Percy is just there to be annoying. And I can't tell if I'm like forgetting an obvious something that happens inside of this book with Percy that would be so important, because like all of Chamber, we kept talking about like the little subtle allusions that like Percy kind of keeps showing up at like the scene of every crime, and he's got his little secret that Ginny knows about and Ginny doesn't get to tell him in time. And it's like, is Percy the one opening the Chamber of Secrets? And it's like, no, he's just sort of like a red herring. But so far, I feel like this book has just been all about Percy just being like a punching bag.
He basically has been. I mean, literally the next sentence is Fred and George barge in just to congratulate Ron on the act of infuriating Percy.
Yes, yes. It's like,
I don't think, it's like Percy's definitely like pompous and he's like kind of annoying, but it's like at some point, like I feel like they're almost like what's he supposed to do, you know?
Right,
like
right.
He's just constantly being berated by all of his brothers for like, you know, being responsible.
Yes.
Something yeah. that his older brothers also were, but like they're like old enough that like Fred and George are just like, yeah, Bill's cool.
Yeah,
that's cool.
yep.
Nah. But when Bill did it, it was cool. When you're doing it, it's sort of like it's a little derivative purse. Okay.
A little derivative. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
Oh man. But so yeah, the next little detail that I find to be kind of odd about the Weasleys in this particular chapter is a story from Mrs. Weasley.
I know. I highlighted this too.
Yeah. She's telling Hermione and Ginny about a love potion she had made as a young girl.
I know. Literally, I was like, excuse me?
I know. Yeah. It's like, oh, I mean, you know, like, because I mean, I think when we're introduced to love potions way down the line by Slughorn, they're sort of like, that's one of the most dangerous potions in this room.
I know.
You know?
But then, like, Fred and George are also selling love potions at, like, Weasley Wizard Wheezes.
That's true.
You know?
That's true. So maybe they got the recipe from Molly Wobbles.
Maybe. Maybe it's like an old family Weasley recipe.
Yeah, I gotta cook up the old love potions.
There must be, like, maybe Amortentia is, like, the strongest love potion, but maybe there's just, like, lesser, like minor infatuation love potions.
I think that's probably more likely. Yeah, there's the heavy hitting stuff, and
right.
and then like more like soft grade.
Right, exactly. Yeah, more like the butterbeer kind of.
Yeah.
This isn't fire whiskey love potion, you know.
Diet love potion.
I know, but I'm like, who were you trying to spike this? Like, that's the thing about love potion, is like you're making it to use on someone. Right. Probably.
Maybe.
Like,
but it also feels like Molly and Arthur have been together. It doesn't feel like, it's the facts. They have been together since they were at Hogwarts together.
Do you imagine in the wizarding world, people who are like already like married, like ever just like experiment with love potions with each other? They're just like, we're already married. What if I took some love potion with like your hair, you know?
Oh,
you know,
it's still moderately uncomfortable to imagine.
I know,
but maybe
like, what would it be like? I want to say yes.
Oh, man.
Someone's done that.
Yeah,
someone's done that. Absolutely. Surely. Yeah.
So anyway, apparently maybe Molly.
Although
this does
possibly Arthur.
Possibly Arthur. It does say that she made as a young girl.
Yeah.
So I mean, I guess we don't know how young relative.
We know they've been sneaking around the castle, you know, together.
Yeah, making love potions.
Making love potions. They like snuck out because the caretaker wasn't Filch then. It was like Og or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. whoever.
Yeah, no, we know some of this backstory. Mm-hmm.
See, this is the thing. This is why Molly actually gets so mad at Fred and George, because she's like, she sees so much of herself in them, and she's like, it's like when you like hate like all the things. Like when your kids do stuff and it's like it annoys you because it's the mistakes you made.
Yes.
And yeah. You're like, no.
You're doing the thing that I did wrong, and I should have taught you better.
It's probably my fault because you're my kids and you genetically inherited that from me. And yeah.
Specifically my love potions.
Specifically. I mean, literally, she's making love potions. They're selling love potions. You know what I'm saying? That's right there.
I know. Yeah. The proof is in the pudding.
Yep. Also, there's a minor description of heaving all their trunks down the leaky cauldron's narrow staircase, which I'm like, guys, did everyone forget we can do magic? Like, why are you carrying these things? Like, you know, and also even narrow staircase, like leaky cauldron, you're the entrance to the magical world. You have a magical entrance. Like, why don't you have like magically wide hallways?
Right.
You know, like there's no excuse. There's no excuse. There should be no heaving and no narrow ever.
And yet. For whimsy.
For whimsy and for the character building, I suppose.
Yeah.
Character, like, you know, strength of will and constitution and stuff, not like, you know, characters in a book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I follow what you're saying. Yeah. It's kind of like when you're growing up and you have to, like, move dirt or something. It's like it builds character.
Builds character.
Dig
exactly.
a hole.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. As if anyone had to ask us. I know.
I love digging holes.
Exactly.
Anyways, so then we get to the two old-fashioned dark green cars, which I highlighted because it just feels like the type of question that would show up in trivia at some point in time.
It sure does.
What color cars take them from the Leaky Cauldron to platform 9 3/4 or King's Cross Station?
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. I thought this was kind of interesting, though, that the cars were green. And then it also says each of the cars was being driven by a furtive-looking wizard wearing a suit of emerald velvet.
It's like... Well.
What is it? Who are these people? Like, what, these valets seem...
The valets.
Seem quite fancy, but also kind of like Slytherin-y.
It's very Slytherin-y. Yeah, very, these very green cars, velvet, high class, expensive sounding.
Oh, yeah. Expensive, right? Because old-fashioned.
Expensive because old-fashioned. Because velvet suits, you know?
Right, yeah.
I mean, there you go. It's also like... Harry talks about how the cars drive, too, and it says he noticed they could slide through gaps. Uncle Vernon's new company car certainly couldn't have managed, which to me is an interesting contrast to the night bus, where the night bus was speeding along, things jumped out of its way.
Yes.
Whereas these cars, like they adjust to their surroundings.
Yes. Which, like, that's like the one in the movie. Is there a joke about like why the long face or something? Because they're like squeezing through two double-decker buses.
Right. Yes.
So I'm reading it as if this is like a milder version of that, where they can sort of like become. You know.
Yeah. They're just sort of driving past and you're like looking past like, oh, this guy driving. Wow. Okay. I see.
Or like when like the motorcycle like kind of shoots between.
Exactly like that.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It's so infuriating.
could you imagine if you ever like open your door to like, you know, like pour out your drink or something because you're like sort of stuck in traffic and then. Yeah. Anyway, that's a total aside.
Yep.
Okay. So let's see here. Then they make it to King's Cross Station and there's the plan as per Arthur Weasley for them to go through the platform in pairs.
Yes.
As there are so many of us. This is sort of like a, it also feels like a little bit of a throwback to Chamber of Secrets where like, because all of the Weasley family went through before Harry and Ron, they were then barricaded on the other side.
So this time Mr. Weasley was like, Harry with me.
Right. I was fined a bunch of money, 50 galleons for your antics last time. So I will be holding your hand.
We're going through first and it will not be, if something happens, everyone will be here to see it.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
Exactly. What's happening there? I do like when they get through there, Percy immediately sees his girlfriend, has to smooth his hair down. But then there's this tiny little glimmer here. It says, Ginny caught Harry's eye, and they both turned away to hide their laughter. It's like, what was that?
They just have a moment.
They just have a moment right there, Harry and Ginny.
I think they just had a moment.
They just had a tiny little moment just right there.
Foreshadowing.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Foreshadowing big time. Yep. Actually having a little private moment together there.
Yep.
And then, oh gosh, such a heartwarming moment here where they're all getting on the train and Mrs. Weasley kissed all her children, then Hermione, and finally Harry. And then I love the next sentence. It says, he was embarrassed, but really quite pleased when she gave him an extra hug. It was like, oh, Harry.
Yep. No. Honestly, I feel like this reminds me a little bit of my mother-in-law. I feel like she is known to do this type of thing. Like, yeah. She'd be like, you know, watching my daughter Addie and in her process of like leaving the home, she'll be like, all right, well, you guys take care. And she'll like, you know, give me a hug, then give my wife a hug, then give me a hug again, and then leave. And it's always sort of like, oh.
A little extra.
That was nice.
Thanks. All right.
But I know, yeah, I do love that because I've brought this up a bunch of times, but I do feel like the relationship between, or one of the most like heart-wrenching things for me about the whole series is the relationship between Molly and Harry and the way in which she just like is like, I will look after him. I care for him. He is basically my own son.
Yes.
You know, and it's just so sweet.
Yeah. It's there from the beginning.
Yes. Yes. And then also Molly's just firing on all cylinders in the mom department today. She said that she made them all sandwiches, which she must have done from the leaky cauldron.
I know, right? You know, she must have.
You think she like, you know, just was
unless
like,
she
like,
brought them from the burrow. She's just been storing these sandwiches for several days.
Yeah, it's like no need for Tupperware in the wizarding world.
You can just
use like a,
like magic, probably
like a freezing charm.
Like a freezing charm, yeah.
It's just exactly. like a little like freezer.
Yeah. Still make them carry the trunks down the stairs.
But still, you got no character.
Yeah, exactly.
She does say, here you are, Ron. No, they're not corned beef.
Yes, which is nice because in the first book, Ron is like, she always forgets I don't like corned beef.
I know, yeah.
It's like, she did remember now.
She remembered.
Yay.
And then also she goes, Fred, where's Fred? Is this a throwback at all? Or is this the case like in book one where it's like, he's not Fred, I am. And yeah. It's like she's always looking for Fred.
Right.
Like when it comes to boarding.
Yeah.
Like is that like a fun like little like running thing there?
Is Fred like always the one like a little off to the side?
It's like, where is Fred?
Where is Fred though? Yeah. These are the kind of things we can hope to see in the Harry Potter TV show that's coming out.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, oh, no, drink, take a sip every time they said, where's Fred?
Where's Fred? Where's Fred?
Where's Fred?
There he is. I would love that if like once an episode like where's Fred and then just like do like a push transition. Fred's like, here's Fred. Here I am.
Yeah, as much Fred and George as they want to give us, there is literally no limit.
Just all of the Fred, all of the George. Let's see it. I love then. So Mr. Weasley pulls Harry aside to have his little private conversation about how, you know, Sirius Black has broken out specifically to find him. And Harry's like, no, I overheard you talking. It's fine. This way you haven't broken your word to Fudge and I know what's going on. And it's like, oh, sort of. I mean, you did still learn from him. You know? Yeah, it's one way of looking at it.
You're good. I just snooped. So
I just snooped.
You didn't break the rules, but I like kind of did. But
kind of, you know, all good. Don't worry.
I know. Yeah, I feel like there's a little bit of like effort in place here to attempt to protect the integrity of Arthur while also still basically letting the exact same information be transferred. But we're also seeing like, you know, we bring it up a lot as well that like if anybody at any point in time was just willing to ask any of the adults for help, then so much could just be taken care of. Although we are seeing quite clearly, and we will continue to see throughout this chapter, that when adults know that there's a problem around Harry, they just keep insisting that he's going to go like looking for danger.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just like, please don't do that. Like nobody's ever solving the problem. They're just telling him what not to do.
Exactly.
And then Harry's like, it's like, Harry, you must be very scared. I'm not, said Harry sincerely. Really? He added because Mr. Weasley was looking disbelieving. I'm not trying to be a hero, but seriously, Sirius Black can't be worse than Voldemort, can he? It's like,
I think we said this before, but when he says, I'm not, it's like, again, I feel like it's like a tiny nod to Harry's like good instincts. It's like, Harry's not afraid. It's like, because if he was afraid, he'd have good reason to be afraid. But he doesn't, because he's like, yeah, Sirius Black's not a threat.
I know. You know.
Not for the reasons he thinks, but Sirius Black can't be worse than Voldemort, can he? To which I think is poor logic. Not to follow up Harry's good instincts with poor logic, but like, the times we've faced Voldemort, he's been like 95% of a loading bar full of memory, and then also like living on the back of Quirrell's head. So like, I'm not sure you've really faced Voldemort, and Sirius Black is apparently at full power and just broke out of Azkaban and is coming to hunt you down specifically. So like, I feel like he could be worse than Voldemort, Harry. You know what I mean?
I mean, you know what I mean? You don't know. Although he did beat full power Voldemort as a baby. So there's that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess.
Although nobody understands why.
Nobody understands why, including Harry. And arguably, Lily did most of the work.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Either way, I love Mr. Weasley. Mrs. Weasley gets in her hugs, but Mr. Weasley has his own little faith in Harry where he says, I knew you were, well, made of stronger stuff than Fudge seems to think, which I love that he's just like, he has a lot of faith in Harry as well.
Yes, yes, yep, yeah. Absolutely. And honestly, that is a huge amount of respect to be coming from like a full-grown adult to a, you know, what is now 13-year-old.
Yeah.
To be like I don't know if I could imagine speaking to a 13-year-old now and be like, I know you're made of strong stuff. You could probably take on a full-grown killer.
Yeah, who's out, who broke out of prison to get you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got this, small
you
child.
You got it. Absolutely. I'm not worried at all.
Not that a 13-year-old's a small child, but you know what I'm saying.
Yes. Okay. But then after this, we have a lovely little bit of Dumbledore's big plan clue action happening here.
Okay. Lay it on.
Okay. So first of all, he gives him the same advice that everyone would keep giving Harry. Like you just said, swear to me you won't go looking for Black. Right? And then he says, swear to me that whatever you hear, don't go looking for Black. And everyone, like, Harry and Ron and Hermione are baffled at this. Like, why would I go looking for someone who's trying to kill me? What weird advice? And it's like, the reason they don't, that part of it, no matter, whatever you might hear. So what he's saying is, if it comes to pass that you find out that Sirius Black betrayed your parents, and that's why Voldemort killed them. Like, that's the reason Harry would go looking for Black, is because he's going to find out that Black is the, like, was the secret keeper.
Right,
like,
yes.
That's what they're afraid of. But here's the thing. There's no reason for Mr. Weasley to know this information. Like, you know, later on, like, who's telling it? Fudge is telling it.
Right.
The three broomsticks.
Yes.
You know, and, like, McGonagall doesn't know, and Flitwick doesn't know, and Hagrid even doesn't know. Like, why does Mr. Weasley know that Sirius Black was the secret keeper?
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, that's a good, I like that interpretation better than what I had, which was like the possibility that maybe this is like Arthur knowing that like Sirius has a history beyond that of being like a convict. Like, no matter if you hear that he was friends with your dad, don't go looking for him.
Ah, I see.
Which I suppose could be information that was known, but I like yours better because I do think that sort of like one of the critical components of Dumbledore's big plan is that Molly and Arthur are like very willingly sort of agents on his behalf to be sort of like in this like looking after role of Harry, and therefore they need certain bits of information. But you're absolutely right, because as good as Molly and Arthur are, they were, you know, parents to young children the last time that Voldemort was in power, and therefore decided not to join the ranks of the Order of the Phoenix.
Right.
Although Molly's brothers, Fabian and Gideon, did, and were of course killed in that duty. But yeah, you're right. Like, so like they're, you know, while they may have known some of the people in that organization, it's not like they were directly inside of it. And Hagrid also doesn't know and was directly inside of it.
Right, exactly.
He is a member of the Order. So.
Yeah. So that to me just screams of Dumbledore's big plan, that like Dumbledore has filled them in a little bit more.
Yes.
On the situation.
Yep, I like there. It.
And it's also worth noting, you might think, well, then why were they arguing about it? And it's like, just because they're working for Dumbledore doesn't mean they necessarily see eye to eye with him at all times. Like, even later, especially Molly, because she's the one who's like, don't tell Harry, or... And Arthur's like, no, we should. But then, like, at the Order of the Phoenix, she's also of the opinion, like, no, don't let him in on the meetings. We're not telling him anything.
Right.
And the rest of them are like, well, but we're going
to. Yeah, right. Yeah, he deserves to know.
He deserves to know.
I think that that's probably part of, like, why Dumbledore would have chosen this particular pairing. Because Molly is always just going to be looking out for Harry's own safety.
Yeah.
It's possible that even Arthur is looking out for his safety, but it's slightly different approaches as to whether or not you think information is helping you or hurting you.
Whether you're safer being ignorant or not.
Right. Yeah. And probably, like, you know, I think if you're Molly, she's probably transposing some of her own worries about Harry and believing that if he knows this information, that he will be as worried as Molly is about him. But I think that's probably like one of those, to Arthur's credit, you know, made of stronger stuff. I feel like Harry just, he's like, he doesn't seem to like dwell as much on these.
Yeah.
It's like someone's out there and wants to kill me. Like, what else is
there? What else is there? Yeah. This is life, right? People want to kill you all the time.
I've been doing this my whole life. I live with the Dursleys.
I live with the Dursleys. You know,
they once left me in a cupboard for a week.
Yeah. Right. My Aunt Marge left me treed for a whole day once.
Yeah.
Till midnight. It was great.
Yeah.
Fine. No big deal. Right. Although it's funny too that Mr. Weasley would like err on the side of information is more important, but he's still hedging at like it. You should know Sirius Black is hunting you, but I don't want you to know about anything else, that he was like friends with your dad or anything, or like I'll give you some information, but not like enough information.
I think that's where he knows that if he gives him too much information, Harry's going to act on it.
Yeah, Harry's going to be like, well, I got to talk to this guy. What do you mean?
Yeah.
How could you?
I got business to be up to.
I got business here. Yeah. Anyway, I'm sure we'll talk about this at length later. But next we're on the train, and there's another just tiny little advancement of character here where Harry wants to talk to Ron and Hermione privately, and Ron has to get rid of Ginny, and so he just says, go away, Ginny. And she just says, oh, that's nice. But it's like, these are just more words from Ginny in front of Harry, like, that are less common at this point.
You're right. Yeah. You're right. Like, I think going back 1 year and Ron saying, go away, Ginny, the phrasing that would have followed would have been like, Ginny turned a brilliant shade of red and stormed off.
Right.
You know, like tears forming in her eyes or something. So it's like, you're right. Like, this is sort of like a little bit of that, like, fierceness that, like you can tell that Ginny is someone who is going to be able to stand up for herself.
Right.
Like, oh, that's nice. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, whatever. Like,
right. You're starting to see, like, her true personality come through.
Yes, yeah.
A little bit more here. Yeah. I wonder how Ron and Harry's life would be different at, like, how their entire life might be different if they were ever at the train early enough to find an empty compartment.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
How about it?
They're always like, why is this train just not have enough either? You know, there's always someone, and they're like, I guess we'll just sit in this one with the random adult in it. That's where I'd go.
This is like one of those things where Lupin sleeping throughout the course of this chapter. So it says they entered the train. It says this one had only one occupant, a man sitting fast asleep next to the window. Like, this is a situation where I think Lupin's being asleep is almost a requirement for the plot, like, because otherwise questions could have been asked. They're on the train for seemingly hours on their way to Hogwarts.
Yeah,
it's like,
right.
It's like too much time would pass without it being like, so tell us about yourself. What's going on? Who are you? Do you happen to know my parents? Were you guys best friends?
Harry, I was friends with your dad in school. You know?
Yes.
Seems like it might have been the first line out of his mouth.
Yes.
You know?
Precisely.
Right.
It's almost odd that even when they do talk, well, maybe it is something that comes up rather quickly. But
no, I mean, can you even imagine? I mean, Scabbers is in the compartment with him.
I know. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, Hermione gets Crookshanks out. Put that away. Scabbers is afraid. Oh, let me see you all rat.
What? Wait.
Hide. Exactly.
So instead, he's going to sleep.
So he's asleep. But at least he wakes up for the Dementor.
Yeah. So he gets there a little bit.
Through the Gryffindor is sponsored by Acorns. Y'all, I remember way back when I was 16 and opening my first checking account, there were two banks offering two different incentives. One would give you $20 for opening a student account, and the other would round up all of your purchases to the next whole dollar and put the excess into like a side account. So if the total was $19.25, the leftover 75 cents would go there. And I loved the idea of the roundups, but being a 16-year-old and mildly short-sighted, I took the $20. Years later, when I discovered that Acorns does exactly this thing, I was beyond thrilled and signed up right away. In fact, the day that my daughter Addison was born, I set up her own account and started sending all of my roundups to her for when she gets older. The thing is, Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing for your future. You don't need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can get started with just your spare change. Acorns recommends an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invest your money for you. So head to acorns.com/griffin or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at tanker.com.
But it is kind of interesting as well, because the Hogwarts Express was usually reserved for students and they had never seen an adult there before except for the witch who pushed the food cart.
Yeah.
I can't even remember exactly what the trolley ladies or the trolley witch's role is in The Cursed Child. But is she also not somehow like a bizarro manifestation of the train?
She kind of sort like seems like maybe she must be. She does chase Albus and Scorpius onto the roof of the train and throw pumpkin pesty grenades at them.
Yeah.
Which is not a sentence I'm making up. That is literally what happens. She throws explosive pastries at them after chasing them to the roof of the train.
Yeah.
Which they then jump off.
How about anyway. That? So the real question is just sort of like, it is kind of interesting to me that Lupin is taking the train. Like
it is. Like, we know, like, it's supposed to be, like, I guess, like, information to you, the reader, that he's, like, poor.
Sure. I guess, like, right? maybe this is, like, a, like, other means of travel were less available to him. The big reason I feel like he's on the train is so that, like, you can get that first touch and know that this is somebody who is trustworthy, somebody who is knowledgeable. Like,
yeah.
you start to build inside of this chapter alone with our very first introduction to him. It's like, despite his sort of, like, shabby appearance, he clearly, like, knows his stuff.
Yeah.
Which is even kind of interesting as well, because as we then move down, there's sort of one of those classic Hermione moments where Ron's like, who do you think it is? And then Hermione like has an answer, and it's like she just has like read his briefcases, of course, but it's hilarious to me that like Hermione always knows.
Yeah.
But she says, Professor R.J. Lupin. And Ron goes, well, how'd you know that? It's on his case, she replied, pointing to a large luggage rack on over the man's head, where there was a small battered case held together with a large quantity of neatly knotted string. The name Professor R.J. Lupin was stamped across one corner in peeling letters. And that's kind of interesting as well, because it's like,
it is.
How long has Lupin been a professor for?
I know.
And where?
Or like, because it seems like you probably just got the job, so why is it peeling?
Yes,
if you just became it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Which also, like, even this is again where it's like, the description of the case, again, it's all supposed to make you think, like, you know, Lupin's, like, you know, I guess poor of lesser means or whatever. And, but like, small battered case held together with large quantity of neatly knotted string. It's like, but magic. Right?
But magic.
Why can't magic fix your case? Because we know you're a good wizard. Like
for the vibes, Jay.
For the vibe. I know, I guess. Like the peeling letters, but like magic.
Yes, yes.
Like
this seems medium solvable.
It seems medium solvable. Yeah. Lupin. That's all I'm saying.
Yep.
Interestingly though, so this is like the I don't know if it's like it like a if this is supposed to be like a flaw in Hermione logic or anything, but like, you know, Ron says, I wonder what he teaches. And Hermione says, that's obvious. There's only one vacancy, isn't there? Defense against the dark arts, which one later this chapter will prove not to be true. But then also hilariously in book 6, Harry will use this same wrong reasoning to come to the conclusion about Slughorn.
That's
like, oh, there's one vacancy, so he must be the defense against the dark arts professor. And it's like, nope.
Right.
But now, Hermione turns out to be right, but she is in fact incorrect about the number of vacancies.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, just for clarification purposes, in case anybody was listening, was like, he is the defense against the dark arts professor. What you mean is that there are actually two new positions. Just we are only, they are currently only aware of the one.
Right.
And the other will be care of magical creatures, of course.
Yeah.
So I do like though, that there's the line that's like, there were rumors that the job was jinxed. And I was like, there's gotta be more than rumors at this point.
I know.
What we will eventually learn is that this position has switched every single year since the day that Tom Riddle arrived in Dumbledore's office to request the job of Defense Against the Dark Arts professor.
Yeah.
When he's actually hiding the diadem. And Dumbledore's like, why are you actually here, Tom? And so it's like, that's been, I mean, we have different estimations sort of like depending, but like 45 plus years, 40 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so it's like no one has ever had the same Defense Against the Dark Arts professor 2 years simultaneously.
At least 2 years simultaneously. Like part of, you're right, because it always says the rumor of job was jinxed. Like, if they have had 45 different professors in that time, it's like, guys, word is out. Like,
something be up.
So it seems almost more likely that there has been like some like turn taking or something. Like, you can't have it more than 1 year in a row, but maybe you could have like alternating professors for a while or something. Or
well, it even goes back a little bit to like, if you want to try to solve a little bit of like Fantastic Beasts inaccuracies, of which there, you know, certainly were more than one, but like Dumbledore has very famously taught like transfiguration. Like, that's sort of like the job that we know that he had, was transfiguration professor before he was headmaster. And then he's like teaching Defense Against the Dark Arts back then. So it's like, maybe this is the type of thing, like, like where different teachers sort of like occasionally would step in and be like, I'm going to do this one this year.
Yeah. Right. You know, sort of fill in where I'm needed.
Maybe they're multi-qualified.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It also seems possible that like based on like all that information as well, that like in Fantastic Beasts, Crimes of Grindelwald, you see Dumbledore teaching like the Boggart lesson.
Yes.
Which then makes it seem like maybe Dumbledore was Lupin's Defense Against the Dark Arts professor, because like maybe that's where he gets the idea from.
Could be. Like, it was like originally like a class that like Dumbledore taught.
Yeah.
Because it stands to reason that Lupin and Dumbledore would be like similar kinds of teachers, because they're both sort of like wise, sort of like calm at their core. Like, they understand like the students in a way that's like very unique. So I could certainly see that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So anyway, we move down here. Harry tells Hermione and Ron that Sirius Black broke out to, you know, hunt him down. Hermione says, don't go looking for trouble. Harry says, I don't go looking for trouble. Trouble usually seems to find me. To which I responded, you know, I wrote down, I was like, what about the time with the two boats, Harry? You know, which is a Lego Batman reference, but it's like a,
The two boats?
What are the time? Yes. No, sorry. Those are... This is what made me think of at the beginning of Lego Batman. The Joker is taking over a plane and he's like threatening the pilot, saying like, let me get it. I'm taking over this plane. And the pilot just looks at him and he goes, he's like, Batman's going to stop you. he's like, no, he's not. And he's like, what about the time with the two boats? And they just start referencing all the other Batman movies. But to me, this was the same energy. It's like, I don't go looking for trouble. And it's like,
Right.
I don't know about that, Harry.
We go through the trap door.
Yeah, we go
tonight.
Tonight we do it. And it's like, I think there's even a line in Chamber of Secrets where he's like, Harry had given up looking for the Chamber of Secrets, but he wasn't going to give up an opportunity if it presented itself. You know? Yeah. He's like, well.
Right. Yeah. I mean, to be fair, Harry is rather uniquely positioned, and it does seem like things sort of like orbit around him, but it doesn't mean that he's not also like kind of stepping right into that frame.
Yeah. He does there.
Go be a part of the action.
I mean, Ron's next question is, how thick would Harry have to be to go looking for a nutter who wants to kill him? Which, to me, I'm like, guys, let's back up a second here. In Philosopher's Stone, you guys 1,000% believed that Snape tried to kill Harry on the broomstick during the Quidditch match, right?
Yeah.
And you also 1,000% believe it's Snape who's going to get the stone.
Yes.
And you go through the trap door. So,
do you want to stop Snape from getting that stone or what?
So, how thick would Harry have to be? Apparently not that thick.
Not that thick. Yeah. As thick as he is.
Yeah. You guys have some real bad memory here.
Right. Yeah.
Thick as he is.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes. Oh, man.
Oh, my gosh. So, yeah, there's some lovely reasoning there. So then we get a nice little interesting, like, bit of, like, confusing red herring foreshadowing something is amiss, where suddenly they start hearing the sneakoscope from the trunk. And, yeah, this is such a good, like, I don't even know if the word is misdirect. It's such a good just little, like, suspicious thing that happens.
It really is. Because like we've already sort of had like the one instance in Ron's letter to Harry where like he's like, I don't think it works though, because it was going crazy last night at dinner, but I think that's because Fred and George put, you know, beetles in Bill's soup or whatever.
But that's not the reason.
Of course, because it was because Scabbers is there.
Scabbers was there.
Yeah.
And Scabbers is here now.
Right.
As well. It's hard to say if that's what I guess that's what it's setting it off, is Scabbers again. like it's suddenly picking up on him or something. Like it seems like it would have started immediately.
Right, right. Like I suppose there's a couple of different things that could be going on there, because it could be that the sneakoscope will only start to whir like whenever like Peter is like, would it always go crazy around Peter, or is it because now Peter is in the same compartment as Lupin and they just finished having a conversation about Lupin. So it's like more, what am I trying to say here? Like now Peter, even if he wasn't actively attempting to hide, he is now attempting to hide because he knows
right,
who
like
else
before
is
he
there.
Was sleeping and now he's like, oh,
right. Yeah. Right. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Now he's like hiding. Yeah. I guess that could be the difference right there.
Like, that's the untrustworthiness. Like Scabbers, yeah. like Peter just being Scabbers at any point in time, isn't just inherently being untrustworthy just for being in his animagus form. It's like the actual like deception needs to be more in play.
Sure.
And because of Lupin being there, it's like now it's deception.
Yes. But then this is also like, it's also a bit of a red herring to make you wonder about Lupin himself.
Yeah.
Because it's going to feel like the whole book that like Lupin must be the one helping Sirius because he's the only new person there.
Right, right. Right. Yeah. And you know, like with this sort of like downtrodden, you know, whatever, it's like, is that supposed to be presenting any amount of suspicion at this character
in
some capacity?
And we know nothing about him. He's just in the compartment and now the sneakoscope's going off. What's going on? Like,
right.
You know, and it's like, it'd be so hard the first time you're reading it to be like, well, who was there the first time? Okay. Right. Yeah. Ron was there. I mean, maybe you'd think Ron was there both times or something.
Right.
You know,
right.
But like, obviously Hermione wasn't there and Harry wasn't there. You wouldn't be like, well, even if you realize, like, I guess Scabbers was there, like you still wouldn't think.
You still wouldn't
Scabbers
think. Yeah.
is the reason.
You just wouldn't have enough to go off.
Yeah.
Of.
And I guess like even as I was reading it this time, I was like, could it be because of the Dementors? But like they don't actually show up for a little bit. So like it's not from the Dementors. So it's like maybe it's for Lupin or maybe it's just going off because it's a cheap one, which is what Ron says later. It's like everything is meant to like confuse you about this scene. It is a very like it happens sort of like just barely even happens, but it is a really like misdirecty kind of like, uh-oh, now we've spun the wheel. Now we don't know where the arrow's pointing.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. No, yeah. You're totally right.
Or is it like, or Sirius Black on the train? Who knows, you know?
Well, because that was my thought as well.
Because they literally just finished talking about him.
Right. Yep, yeah. That's true. But like, yeah, because that is very interesting because I highlighted that line, like, you know, mind you, it's a very cheap one.
Yeah.
Like in reaction to Hermione's like, is that a sneakoscope? And it's like, clearly it doesn't matter. So it's like Ron did in fact buy what was ever otherwise like maybe like a little bit of like a tchotchke sort of like souvenir.
Right.
Like it's not a high end device no matter what.
Right.
You know, so it's like, but it seems to be working rather well.
Right.
Which
Ron's insistence and even Bill's insistence that it's like sort of cheap and just for tourists. It's just like, it's meant to make you think like, yeah, like you've seen these things a million times in gift shops. Like,
yes,
they don't really work, but like it does work.
Yes, yeah, like, exactly. Yeah, like, yeah.
They're all wrong about it. It just works.
It just works. Yeah. Like, it's accurate.
It's accurate. Yes. And yeah.
It points north.
It points. Exactly. That's right. You know what? A compass you buy at the gift shop still points north.
Magnetic north is magnetic north.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. You know, it's easy to make them because they don't require much.
Right. Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
So yeah, that is definitely like a little bit of a little bit of an interesting one as well. Because like, you know, there really is a lot of suspicion building happening inside of this chapter altogether. Then Harry does hide it in a particularly horrible pair of Uncle Vernon's old socks,
mm-hmm.
Which is another one of those questions that I feel like has come up in trivia a bunch of times.
It has.
So.
Knobbly, I believe, right?
Well, does it say knobbly?
Maybe not this time.
Okay. Maybe
they become knobbly.
Yeah, okay.
right now, they're just particularly horrible.
Yeah. Okay. The room to evolve.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So from there, the conversation drifts away from Sirius Black and towards Hogsmeade, because that's obviously going to be a huge obstacle for Harry. And there's just a sentence here or a paragraph where Ron is describing Honeydukes. He just says, it's a sweet shop. They've got everything. Peppermints that make your smoke at the mouth. Great fat choco balls full of strawberry mousse and clotted cream. And really excellent sugar quills that you can just suck in class. And it's like, I feel like it is paragraphs like this one in particular that make people love the Wizarding World. It's like nothing is happening here. You're just learning about it. It just sounds fun and whimsical and great, and like you want to be there.
Yes, yeah. I know. No, it's so true. And I even highlighted the Sugar Quill one because that's like that's one of those where I'm always kind of like, is this really all that inventive? But then like when you think about yourself, actually somebody commented while we were on tour, so I'm gonna bring it up again, how whenever we're doing Jay versus Ben's over on the Super Carlin Brothers channel,
yes, they did.
I have a tendency to take the Apple pencil and like poke my teeth with it.
Yeah.
And it's apparently it was upsetting somebody due to the lack of sanitary nature. So my apologies. I'm going to do my best to not do it, although we have since filmed more and I did actually do it again. But anyway, so it's funny because whenever I think about the Sugar Quills, I'm always just sort of like, is that really that creative? It's just sort of like a wizard-shaped object but made of sugar. But then the idea that you would be sitting in class and doing that sort of like pensive thinking, like tapping your...
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, like sucking on the end of your quill or whatever. It's like, oh, it's a treat. I get it. It's yeah. like, it's kind of deceptive.
Yes.
Like the teacher who probably just thinks you're thinking.
Right.
But actually,
but like, even like how much would a teacher even care? You know,
probably not that
I
much.
I know, not yeah. that much. Although even some like the pepper imps make your mouth smoke and the sugar quills are at least like, yeah, maybe a bit of a trick or something. But like great fat chocolate balls full of strawberry mousse and clotted cream. Like that's just candy. That's just muggle candy.
It just sounds good.
That just sounds like we could make that.
Yeah. Yeah.
We mere muggles. Yes. Probably.
I do think it's very funny as well because Hermione interjects inside of this amazing list from Ron. And she's like, oh, in the in Sights of Historical Sorcery, it says the inn was the headquarters to the 1612 Goblin Rebellion, speaking of Hogsmeade. And then also that the Shrieking Shack is supposed to be the most severely haunted building in Britain, which is kind of like one of those things where I'm like, is it? Though, like, I can't remember. I mean, this is like a detail where it's like maybe I just need to like review one piece of detail. But
yeah,
like, did you do this?
No, what
has the Shrieking Shack existed before the Whomping Willow?
Oh no, I don't think so.
Okay, because otherwise we know that the Whomping Willow is planted in what we have this number somewhere like 1971.
Yeah,
because it's the year that Lupin himself comes to school, and this is only 1993. So it's like. It's the Shrieking Shack has only been there for 22 years, and like it was only really inhabited by Lupin during his 7 years at school.
Yeah.
So it's like it really. I mean that, and even then, it was only inhabited by Lupin during the full moon.
Yeah.
So
and only while he was at school. So if you want to say it's like, well, I guess summer for them is like 8 weeks, so like 2 months. So it's like. 10 months for 7 years. I mean, it's like 70 nights over the course of a decade.
Wait, where
like someone is genuinely screaming and stuff in there.
Right. You know. So people are hearing it, but like the most haunted?
The most haunted? Yeah, I don't know. Just feels like the sort of legend that pops up around it. But again, to your point from earlier, if only Lupin was awake. Oh, the Shrieking Shack.
It was built for me.
He'd be like, ah, don't worry, it's not haunted. Trust me. Yeah. I'm sure he wouldn't tell them, but
probably not. Yeah. Trust me,
it's not.
It's not as bad as people say.
Yeah. No one's made any noise in there, and at least I'm sure this would be the sort of thing where if he was awake, but that place hasn't been haunted since year I graduated.
Yeah, it's been like 15 years.
It's been like 15 years.
Nobody's heard a peep.
No one's heard a peep. Yeah, he'd be like, "How do you know? That's weird."
It would have been fine though. I'd been like, "All right, sure." New mysterious sleepy man.
Exactly. We'll just take your word for it. But at this point, of course, you would already know that, oh, I was friends with your father at school, Harry. Yes.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. Oh, great friends, your dad. He used to be able to transform into a deer. Did you know that?
Fun fact.
What if Lupin, that should be our next one. What if Lupin was awake on the train?
I know. Yeah. People are like, what?
What?
There's so much that could have happened.
They talk about literally every plot point, just about it. Maybe not the time turner, but might not have come to that had he just been awake.
Right.
Yeah. Let's see.
More on the Hogsmeade though. We can, they're like, Ron has the idea. We can ask Fred and George. They know every secret passage out of the castle. Yeah. That's kind of a funny one because it's like,
Yes. Just like setting up the Marauder's map a little bit later as well. And that, even that note about the Shrieking Shack is setting you up for like a location later in the book.
That's true. Yeah. Just kind of like laying some groundwork.
Yeah. The sooner you mention it, the less it was like it, the more it was always going to be there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It feels less shoehorned in.
Yes. But like even the way it's like sandwiched between Ron's list of things is like, you don't even think about it. Like, it's like Ron's listing off all these fabulous candies. Hermione's like, history. And you're like, shut up, candy. You know,
I want more candy explanation.
Yep. Meanwhile, then we get them arguing about how Harry indeed should not go to Hogsmeade because Black is out there. And they say, do you really think he's going to worry about attacking Harry just because we're there? Which, I keep bringing this up, but it's like, yeah, you're right. But also still no Dementors in Diagon Alley. Like if that's your defense, you know, is he going to care that other people were there? Apparently not.
No, we just needed the dramatic entrance.
Yeah. The answer is they wanted a dramatic entrance for the Dementors. So it doesn't make sense for them to be at Diagon Alley, even though it 1,000% makes sense for them to have been there.
Right.
That's all.
Right.
Anyway. Go ahead.
I was going to say, at the same time, though, then we also, in addition to having the Sneakisope kind of going haywire, Crookshanks also shoots out of the basket at this particular point in time, where you get like a little bit more of like the debate between, Hermione and Ron, who Ron is now all of a sudden extremely worried about the health and safety of Scabbers.
Yep.
During this particular incident, though, you have another moment where Lupin stirred and they watched him apprehensively, but he simply turned his head the other way, mouth slightly open, and slept on. So Lupin really just snoozing up a storm, missing everything.
Right? You get a nice little just weather setup happening here too. Like as they're moving towards the school, it becomes wilder and darker outside. And then mid-afternoon, it just started to rain. So you're really setting the stage for the Dementors to show up. It's like, it's not like in the middle of a sunny day. It's like, yeah, things are already, it's like, it's bad weather. It's raining out there. The Dementors are coming.
Some ghostly creatures that kind of look like Death himself are about to arrive.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah. Like everything about them arriving on the train is so silly. Malfoy shows up. He sees Lupin for the first time and Malfoy's like, whoa, never mind. I'm not going to beat you up.
Whatever. Not with a teacher sleeping soundly right next to us or anything.
I do think this is there's like Malfoy's being a jerk as usual, but there's a nice little like subtle dig that happens here where he opens the compartment door and just says, Potty and the Weasel. So he addresses Harry and Ron, but Hermione is there and like he makes fun of them and calls them calls them names. He does not even acknowledge Hermione's existence. Like as a person in the room.
Interesting. You know? Yeah, that's a good note. And it is kind of surprising too, because I mean, you would have had so much from it wouldn't have seemed unlike Malfoy to say Potty the Weasel and the Mudblood.
Right, yes.
You know, like, I mean, it feels, it's like I always feel very uncomfortable myself saying it. Like, I feel like I'm like
oh,
I also recognize how awful it is to say. But, it's not like he doesn't have an insult to sling her way that we've heard him say out loud before.
Oh, I know. We know, he actively hates her, but, now he's treating her, beneath, acknowledgement.
Yeah,
yes. Yeah. So I hadn't quite noticed that lack of acknowledgement in the past. That's another look what Malfoy. What a little turd.
Yeah, I know, yeah. I know. Yeah, speaking of turd, there's a line from Ron that for whatever reason stands out to me and almost doesn't feel like it fits inside of the book, which is, I'm not going to take any crap from Malfoy this year. For whatever reason, it just feels like a sentence like someone I went to high school would have said. Like, I'm not taking any crap from him.
Right.
It's just like, I don't know, like the casual.
Doesn't sound like British enough or wizardy enough or something.
Yeah, like any crap.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Not a word you typically use there, Ron, but all right. You know, it's fine here. Let's see. So then just so next up though is the Dementor's arrival, on the train where, the train just comes to a complete stop. And then without warning, all the lamps go out and they're plunged into total darkness, which I'm just like, why is it without warning? You know, why is it like, hey, we're going to stop the train at one point and just have some people search it just for your safety. Be aware, all of the lights will go out.
Yeah.
It, you know, yeah, like
this feels like a coordinated, planned, intended activity that would have been like vetted through the driver of the train. And
yeah,
everybody would be like, hey, just so you know, before we get to school, before anybody's been able to get off, we're going to come to a complete stop.
Right.
We're going to do a quick search to make sure Black's not on here. Because once we cross the threshold into all the safety boundaries of Hogwarts, you know, like
right,
then he's on the inside and then we can't do anything about it. So,
right,
you know, it's like it feels like there's a completely plausible way. But also, it's like this feels like such a dangerous way to go about everything. It's like, and it's such an abrupt stop that like luggage is falling off the racks.
I know.
Everybody's sort of in a state of disarray. It's like the lack of safety involved with this maneuver is
right,
massive.
Is it a coordinate? It almost makes me think like it's almost not. Like the Dementor just, they're like, there's the train, better check it. You know?
Yeah.
And they just swoop down and like the driver doesn't even know. He's just like, oh, okay, yeah, go ahead and check.
Let me just slam on the brakes.
Let me slam on the brakes real quick for you.
For these amortal beings.
Yeah, right? Seems weird. Seems weird. Especially if Lupin knew, maybe Lupin didn't know it was going to happen either, but it seems like if he knew, like, maybe don't fall asleep, dude.
I know, yeah. And I mean, just for what it's worth, like the rain is hammering, the train is rattling, the wind is roaring, but still, Professor Lupin slept.
I know.
This guy, man.
Did you take like a sleeping potion, man? Yeah, you know, come on.
He's like a beacon for like a NyQuil commercial.
I know, yeah. He's out. So anyway, they do come to a complete stop and suddenly they like feel like things are moving. They think things are like moving around outside the train. Like maybe they're being boarded or something. And Hermione, he's like, I'm going to go ask the driver what's going on. To which I was just like, Gryffindor. People are like, why is Hermione in Gryffindor? That's brave.
Yeah.
She's like, you don't know anything about why the train just stopped and you're about to go out there.
Yes. Like, yeah. I mean, in kind of like a leadership sort of mode. It's like, I'll go talk to who's in charge.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is honestly exactly what Lupin does when he wakes up.
It's true, yeah. So Hermione's instincts are right on point.
Yeah.
It's kind of hilarious or kind of odd. I kept thinking that there might be like more of a significant reason for this to happen. But upon this stop happening, apparently like Neville and Ginny have both managed to like exit their own compartments and find their way successfully in the dark into Harry and Ron's. And it's like in Hermione's. And it's like, just like
why?
Yeah. It's almost like Neville sort of like stumbles in and maybe it's just like a way to like reintroduce Neville more into the story to be like, ah, yes, there he is. He's clumsy again. He's fallen in and landed painfully over Harry's legs.
Yeah.
You know, but it's kind of like, It really seems to me like the more, although maybe this is more just speaking to exactly what you just said for Gryffindors. It's like all the lights go out and then Ginny, Hermione, and Neville are all like, let's take action.
Yeah, let's go ahead and look around out here. I guess Ginny says, I was looking for Ron, but, you know, like, why?
Just stay where you are.
Yeah.
Cool. Feels like a thing. Finally, though, apparently it was the utter darkness that will finally wake Lupin.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Who says, quiet.
Right. His first words.
Yay.
Yay, Lupin.
That feels like a fun piece of trivia. What's the first word that Lupin says?
Yeah, Lupin says, quiet. Yeah.
Oh, man, somebody's going to ask me that.
I know. Yeah, you're going to be like,
oh, boy, I can't remember now.
Welcome, class.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Eat some chocolate.
Yes, that's exactly. I bet I would go for something like that.
Yeah.
Also,
Lupin then whips out a spell that will never happen again.
I know.
By anyone, surprisingly.
Although it's quite the satisfying spell.
It is. Yeah. There was a soft crackling noise and shivering light filled the compartment. Professor Lupin appeared to be holding a handful of flames. It's like, whoa. Wait a minute, what? No one has done this before. No one will do it again. It just sounds awesome.
It sounds very cool.
Yeah.
It sounds like Lumos, but better.
Yeah, sounds like Lumos, but better.
Instead of like a small, like little like phone light, it feels more like whimsical and stuff. I mean, would we compare it at all to like Hermione's like little bluebell flame?
It kind of is like that. So, I mean, and to that end, you could almost immediately start drawing parallels between Lupin and Hermione.
That's true.
I mean, they sort of fill the same role in their generations.
Yep.
So
yep, love that. They're definitely both like the slightly more grounded ones who are there to like sort of attempt to serve that role of you know, preventing the other two from getting into more mischief.
Yes, and we don't know Lupin's a werewolf yet, but he has reasons to be like an outcast in the wizarding world, where Hermione's like a muggle born.
Yeah.
Not that either of them should be outcast, just that they both are.
Yeah, it is their experience.
Yes, it is their experience. Yeah. Yes.
But then, you know, obviously, as everything is here kind of taking place, we do see that the Dementor comes to their door, and, like, you can see the hand protruding from the cloak, and it's glistening, grayish, slimy, scabbed-looking, like something dead that had decayed in water.
Ugh, gross.
Which that description just sounds absolutely horrible, but it also reminds me like a little bit of like the Inferi.
You're right.
Which I thought was kind of interesting because it's like,
I guess, it's sort of the same thing. Like Inferi, I mean, they're not really alive. Like, so they can't like die per se. You know, they're just like animated by dark magic.
Yes. Yeah. There's a really funny line from Ron somewhere when he's asking Snape about the difference between a ghost and an Inferi.
Yeah.
He's like, transparent.
Yes. Yes. And apparently.
Yeah. But no, so that thought did cross my mind a little bit where I was like, is there any world where, because like, you know, an Inferi is like a dead body, which means it wouldn't have a soul. And these seem like kind of soulless,
soul-sucking creatures.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, Inferi might not always look like they're decayed underwater. It's just
those
ones we meet are
underwater. That's a good point. That's a good point. Because I guess they also talk about like the army of Inferi, which I always just sort of picture as like a legion of like zombies. But I guess that's not necessarily exactly how that would play out. Let's see here. Then we get the effect of the Dementors, which also it seems like it just sort of immediately goes on the offensive. They hear the long, slow, rattling breath as though it was trying to suck something more than air from its surroundings. An intense cold swept over all of them. Harry felt his breath catch in his chest. The cold went deeper than his skin. It was inside his chest. It was inside his very heart.
Mm.
Ugh, sounds terrible.
It does sound terrible. I don't think this will be the case, because they seem to be such allies of darkness and stuff. But, like, is there any scenario where, like, they too were sensing Peter in the cart or something? Like, someone's hiding themselves in here or something.
That's an interesting question.
You know, because it doesn't, like, Lupin has to, like, Patronus this thing away.
Yeah.
And, like, certainly in all of the other compartments, they must have just been like, okay, see ya, you know.
Yeah, you're not wrong. Yeah. I don't hate that either. Because, I mean, realistically, I would say, even to the point of Crookshanks, you know, you've now got the Sneakoscope, Crookshanks, and Dementors all converging or being on the behavior that we know them to have.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, they've even said, I think before, like, the Azkaban guards haven't failed yet in regards to, like, finding Sirius Black. So their ability to, like, suss out mischievous behavior must be quite good.
Yeah.
And probably part of the reason they can't find Sirius is because Sirius isn't actually guilty.
Right. Oh, that's probably it too.
You know,
although they do eventually find him.
I guess that's fair.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. That's the, I like your thinking there. Like because sometimes I tend to think that they're still like agents of evil and they are like seeking out like Harry. Just being like, well, he's right there.
You
know? Like, why not? We'll take a stab. And very nearly, I mean, if Lupin's not there, it's kind of like, what happens in the rest of the scene?
What if somewhere else?
Yeah. We could do, what if Lupin was just awake on the train, or what if Lupin never woke up?
Yeah. Or what if Lupin, you know, took the flu network?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
What if they got there early and chose an empty compartment?
Yes.
For once. Yeah.
Then, of course, Harry starts to hear the screaming, terrible, terrified, pleading screams, which is, of course, Lily.
Yeah, we won't find that out for a while.
Yep. And then there's sort of like the swirling white fog as he sort of, well, not sort of, he just passes out.
Yes.
And then he's being awoken by somebody slapping his face. And Harry wakes up to just basically everybody peering over him. Everybody's asking if he's okay. Harry's definitely doing like his best to be like, yeah, everything's fine.
I'm fine. Who screamed? To which, again, short-term memory, you guys. They're all like, nobody screamed, Harry. And it's like, guys, you remember last year when Harry was like, there's a voice in the wall. And you're all like, that's not good, Harry.
Hearing voices is really bad, even Harry, in the wizarding world.
It's like, yeah, turned out that was a basilisk. No one listened to him. So Harry's hearing things again. So maybe pay attention.
But yeah. I mean, yeah. That could
not
be important.
That they don't know what caused it this time, but.
Right.
Yeah.
I like how the thing that interrupts the conversation, though, is a loud snap that makes them all jump because Professor Lupin was breaking an enormous slab of chocolate into pieces.
You know, I always imagine when they say this, like that he has like a giant like a rock like a boulder of chocolate.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
not like a bar, not like a large bar. When they say like, it says, yeah, what does it say? A slab.
A slab.
An enormous slab. I'm always imagining like when you go to like an Indian restaurant and they've got like the meat going around on like the spigot or something, yeah. like something in that shape.
Okay.
You know, like big old, like he's chiseling off
yeah, like
a piece of chocolate.
His emergency slab of chocolate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Just in case.
Yeah.
You never know if you're going to need to break off a gigantic piece in a loud cracking kind of way. This is another one though, like where I feel like whenever they talk about like somebody like apparating on scene, there was a loud crack and it's like, all right, how loud was the crack really? Because it seems like people couldn't be so subtle about doing this particular activity if it's always making car backfire noises.
I know, right?
Like, that's yeah. very loud.
Very loud. I always imagine the pop to be more like those little like snappers you have on the 4th of July where you throw it at the ground and it's like, pop, you know?
Yeah, yeah. yeah. Maybe that's the loud crack we're yeah, talking about.
That's the loud one.
That seems like, you know, if you had a properly tempered brick of chocolate, you know, it might make that kind of snapping noise.
Exactly.
I could see it.
Yeah, yeah.
Why not?
Anyway, also, I always love about the chocolate warming you up after a Dementor is that it goes into that line from Dumbledore where he's like, of like children's tales and chocolate frog cards or whatever.
Yeah.
That like Voldemort understands nothing, Harry.
Yes.
And it's like, this is so like the same thing. It is like chocolate is the answer to Dementors. Candy overcomes evil.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like I do love that sentiment as well, because I think that's another thing that just makes you fall in love with the world a little bit, is that it's like something as delightful as candy can be like a solution.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then love finally, they ask the question, what was that thing? And Lupin answers, a Dementor.
Oh.
So we finally get to refer to them by their given name.
Yes. And he quickly explains too, one of the Dementors of Azkaban, not just like, so that you're clued in, it's not just like, oh, a Dementor exists next to prisoners or, you know, like, so you know that these are the guards.
These are the guards.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
These are the guards.
Yeah. Yep. So it's not just like some type of vicious creature that was like out in the night.
Yeah.
So yeah, it should give them like a little bit more authority and a little bit less like, ah, yes, you know, like they're quite scary, aren't they? But that's sort of what they're there to do, is be
exactly.
quite scary
to
for.
Be quite scary.
Yeah. For all those people in
surprising Azkaban. I guess we don't know if the sneak is still ever stopped, but it seems like maybe the Dementor should have set it off too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. But it's in those knobbly old socks.
Now it's in those socks, so yeah, maybe it's you just can't hear it, yeah. you know, over the screaming.
They're sound dampening socks.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
Noise canceling
socks.
Yeah. From Bose.
From Bose. You put these on your feet, you can't hear anything.
Not so bad.
That does sound like a wizarding kind of invention.
It kind of
these
does.
These are soundproof socks.
It's like, honestly, it sounds like a delightful thing to like take a nap in.
Yes.
You know, it's like slip on these like warm socks and immediately you can't hear any intrusive noises.
That would be actually, I don't hate it at all. It's like, you know what? Sound canceling headphones are amazing, except for the fact that they're giant and you have to wear them on your head.
Yeah.
You know, what if you could have that effect, but just wear the socks on your feet?
And they're quite cozy. Yeah, I like it.
Oh, yeah. I'm into this idea. So then we get our first description of a Patronus as well. Lupin muttered something and a silvery thing shot out of his wand at it. But like, again, the Dementor didn't move even after Lupin says, none of us is hiding Sirius Black under our cloak. So it's like the other compartments wouldn't have had Patronus power, you know,
yeah.
to get the Dementors to leave. Like, is it the fact that Harry like passes out or something? You know, I feel more like they know something's in this compartment.
Yeah. 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 I agree with you.
Okay.
I agree with you. Yep.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. I did not really ever pay attention to this, but there's like a couple of descriptions of Ginny. It says Ginny was huddled in a corner looking nearly as bad as Harry. And then Ron says Ginny was shaking like mad though. And it's like, yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense.
Cause yes.
like, you know, as of last year, Ginny must have tons of just terrible memories, very recent.
Yes, I wrote the exact same thing down. I highlighted it and I was like, this actually makes a lot of sense after the diary, but I had also not particularly caught that before. But even that I feel like is a little bit of like an additional like parallel, like tying a couple of strands, you know, like Harry and Ginny.
Yeah.
they're together-ish.
They're together. You know, yeah. They're having similar experiences.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Harry then takes his great bite of, or takes a bite of the chocolate, and to great surprise, rather, felt warmth spread suddenly through to the tips of his fingers and toes. And again, just kind of cool. Let's see here. Lupin then also, it says, we'll be at Hogwarts in 10 minutes, said Professor Lupin. Are you all right, Harry? And it says, Harry didn't ask how Professor Lupin knew his name.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you could assume that, like, while he was passed out, they could have been like, Harry, you know.
I mean, there's that. And then there's also just the additional, like maybe that's like one of those details where that line in there is supposed to tell us, like, he hadn't had any other reason to have learned his name. Because, like, even when Harry enters, like, anywhere, it seems like people are like, goodness gracious.
Oh,
are you Harry Potter?
Like, absolutely. It's supposed to tip you off the reader that, right. Like, Lupin knows Harry on his own.
On his own, for some other reason.
But how could he? Yeah, maybe he saw the scar. Does he look like James? Maybe the other kids said it while he was passed out. We don't know. But it is like a pay attention to that. Line
yes.
For you, the reader.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. Let's see. We have the chocolate. We have, and then, oh, this is fun. So Harry gets out there and they finally get on the carriages that bring them up to the castle. And Harry, it says, Harry can only assume by an invisible horse, which one? Yes, correct. But like, as a reminder, Harry missed this last year because they drove the car.
Yes. Yeah.
So this is his first experience with the horseless carriages or the thestral carriages.
The thestral drawn carriages. Yep. Yep. So that's pretty cool. It is interesting to me that it says that they smell faintly of mold and straw, which if you've ever been inside of a barn before, I was like, I can smell it.
It smells it. Yeah, that's
I know.
Like.
I know that smell.
Faintly.
Faintly.
Mold and straw.
Mold and straw.
Sounds about right.
I've been there.
Yep. Then let's see. This is almost unbelievable to me. Neville's having a bad entrance into this book, but Malfoy comes up and says, "You fainted, Potter? Is Longbottom telling the truth? You actually fainted?"
I know.
Neville? Are you doing? Why would you tell Draco this?
Right, yeah. Neville's in the carriage with Draco making small talk.
Yeah.
Did you hear about Harry?
I'm trying to make friends. What, with Draco?
No.
Don't.
Learn something, Neville. Remember the remember all? Oh, no, you probably don't. Yeah. So I highlighted that too. And I was like, come on, Neville.
I know. Like, dude. For that matter, why are you just talking about it at all? You know?
Yeah.
You know, why are you blabbing, man?
Yeah. Neville not at his best.
Not at his best just yet.
They do make it inside of the castle into the Great Hall. Harry can sort of like briefly glimpse the enchanted ceiling where they're going to go and have like the Great Feast. But before walking in, there's sort of an interesting thing that happens, which is that McGonagall shows up out of nowhere and it says, Potter, Granger, I want to see you both. And this is kind of like a fascinating scene to have unfold for a couple of reasons. Because one is that it's kind of like, could this not wait like a little bit? Because there's like a rather prominent central activity to like the start of year, which is the sorting ceremony, which as far as I know, McGonagall typically is the one to like,
yes,
you know, enact as the deputy headmistress to the school.
I know. And apart from that, even if you want to say that like it's not part of the deputy headmistress job, if you want to say the different heads of houses like rotate this job per year or something, which I don't even think is true. I do think it's just McGonagall usually.
Okay.
But like, even if you wanted to say that, like, she is still the head of Gryffindor, and you'd think she'd want to be there to see the new Gryffindors?
Yeah, like to see her new pupils.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like you like that, not only for her benefit, but for their benefit. To be like, this is who you will be reporting to. Like, this is the person who will have your back. This is the head of your house. You know?
Like, instead it's sort of like, you'll meet McGonagall later.
Yeah. In class.
She's important and stern.
And stern.
It's gonna be a great intro for all you first years.
I know. Like, it's so surprising that McGonagall just skips the sorting.
It's very surprising. But again, it's like one of those instances where it's like, this is like, I think the book that throws me off the most whenever the question of like, how many sorting hat songs does Harry end up hearing? Because it's like first year, fourth year, fifth year, sixth year?
Yeah.
Is that the breakdown? But like, we miss second and third. Second because of the flying car. Third because of this weird little like pull aside.
Mm-hmm.
Which just seems like a strange time to do this. Because again, sort of as like we've theorized before, why she's talking to Harry is just to basically be like, I want Madame Pomfrey to take a look at you. Professor Lupin wrote ahead saying that the Dementors came on the train. I want to make sure everything's okay. Are you okay? Okay, good. But then also she's like, well, now I need to talk to Miss Granger, which of course is her giving Hermione her course schedule early and the time turner,
and
which
the time
I guess is something she needs to do privately. But there are other students who probably have been given time turners before. So like, it just seems like there's another time, another place that this could happen.
I know.
The moment you walk into the castle.
Absolutely seems like there is a different time and place for this, like, I don't know, breakfast tomorrow or, you know. Like,
yes.
You know, just even go up at the feast and just be like, Miss Granger, come to my office at 8 tomorrow.
Yes.
We have things to talk about.
Right. Exactly. Yep.
Whatever it is. I love, though, that I would love to know what note she sent to Madame Pomfrey. Because she seems to have no clue what she's doing down there. Like, she sees Harry and she says, oh, it's you, is it? Like, oh, didn't tell him it was Harry. And then she also tells him it was a Dementor, Poppy. It's like, did she just, like, what is the note? Like,
my office immediately.
My office immediately. Yeah.
It's like, Madame Pomfrey's like, I'm missing the feast. What's going on?
I know. Come on.
Oh, it's you. Great.
Oh, it's you.
But we do get a little bit of like credit building. So like, as much as you could even think that earlier in the chapter, there was some suspicion meant to be built around Lupin. There's a line where Harry's basically saying like, I'm fine. And Madame Pomfrey's like, well, he should at least have some chocolate. And Harry's like, well, I've already had some. Professor Lupin gave it to me. And Madame Pomfrey's like, oh, did he? Like, approving. So we finally got a Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher who knows his remedies. So it's like, I feel like that's like one of those where it's like, this is Madame Pomfrey, who is sort of like universally regarded as like good at what she does.
Yes.
Being like, thumbs up.
Thumbs up, Lupin, yay.
Star of approval.
There you go. So they make it back to the Great Hall, and Harry sees that like people are all staring around him, and apparently the story of his collapsing in front of the Dementor has made it all the way through the school already, to which I'm like, did seriously no one else collapsed? Like, you know, it just seems surprising. No one else was affected so badly.
I know, especially because even that's another thing that Madame Pomfrey says is that she's basically saying, like, he won't be the last one who collapses. He's all clammy, they are, and they have the effect on people who are, well, I guess, who are already delicate.
But delicate.
It feels like it's.
I'm not
saying,
delicate.
Yeah, I'm not delicate. It seems like, though, it's like, this is not a completely uncommon response.
I know. She's like, this won't be the last time, but like, they're not supposed to be in the school. They're just supposed to be at the entrances. So like, hopefully no one else is even really coming that close to them.
Exactly.
But,
yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, I love this little line here. As Dumbledore rises to speak, it says, you couldn't help trusting Albus Dumbledore. And as Harry watched him beaming around at the students, he felt really calm for the first time since the Dementor had entered the train compartment, which to me is like the, just another, it's like, We constantly compare Dumbledore to phoenixes, and phoenixes like song has the ability to like raise your morale. And yes. It's just like, this almost seems like a magical lifting of spirits. It's not just that you're seeing Dumbledore. It's that he is literally magically making you feel better.
Yes.
Yes.
Yep. 100%. No, I love that. I think that totally contributes to that theory that like, whether or not Dumbledore is a phoenix, it seems like he embodies many of the qualities of one.
Right.
Somehow, some way. So yeah, I love that. He welcomes everybody as per always. I feel like he sort of does like a really great job of speaking of the Dementors in a way that it like comes across as like reasonable and not actively being like very open about how he feels about it. Although I feel like if you know Dumbledore and you know how he feels, it's like apparent that he's sort of like, you know, don't mess with them. Like, they are dangerous.
Right.
They are non-discriminant. They will attack basically anybody.
Right.
Like, he's like, these are dangerous things, you know, and I don't know. It comes across to me as if he is like exuding his disapproval of their being there without actually saying those words.
Yeah, pretty much. And then like, he has his little line here, says, Dementors are not to be fooled by tricks or disguises or even invisibility cloaks, he added blandly.
But like,
absolutely, he's just talking to Harry.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Everybody's like,
Harry,
invisibility cloak.
Yeah, like, who has one? I don't even know. And he's like, I gave it to him. Yes, yeah. Yes. I get it.
Yep.
Might be my own downfall here. Please don't do that.
Right.
Yes. Let's see. Then we get the introduction of the two new teachers, Hagrid and Lupin. So, as you know, Hermione earlier was incorrect about her assertion that there's only one opening.
Yep.
Then we get a clue about Snape. Ron notices, look at Snape. And he's noticing, looking over at Lupin and saying that his expression was beyond anger. It was loathing, which is just another clue that... Lupin was friends with James.
Yes. Yep. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. Definitely one of those where it, I mean, it kind of hails back. It reminds me a lot of Sorcerer's Stone, where like Harry makes eye contact with Snape and like feels like his scar burn, but like Quirrell's head is like turned away. So it's actually like he's feeling Voldemort's effect on him, not yes. Snape's. But yes. This is like another instance where like there's like a little like what's Snape doing during the start of year feast? Because it always seems like it's a little bit like, Little nudges about what's going to happen later in the story.
I know, yeah. Pay attention, pay attention.
Yep.
Then there's also, we learn that Hagrid's taking care of, or teaching care of magical creatures. But in addition to his gamekeeping duties, which are apparently already full-time, but to me, I'm like, why? Right. Why? Let him teach the classes. Come on. Hire a new gamekeeper.
I know.
Why?
Especially when, you know, like the very next page, it, you know, they go up to congratulate Hagrid on his brand new position. And they're like, he says, it's all down to you three. And he's like, you know, wiping his shining face on his napkin and looking down on them. He says, it's what I've always wanted. And, you know, it's like, this is information that Dumbledore certainly knows about Hagrid, who he has like looked after for 51 years, you know, as like a member of staff and such. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's like, we can hire a gamekeeper, I'm sure. Right. I'm sure. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
Give him get a gamekeeper. Free him up. How, you know, you're setting him up for failure here. It was a full-time job being gamekeeper.
He's got, yeah, he's got
two. Now he's got to teach. Fire. Now he's got to teach at least four classes a day.
Right.
You know?
Right. But next year, he will not only be teaching care of magical creatures, he will also be the gamekeeper and breeding blast-tended scroots and courting Madame Maxime.
Yeah.
So yes. Hagrid's a busy guy.
Hagrid's a busy guy.
He just keeps, you know? He's got a lot going on.
A year after that, he takes a vacation to France, you know?
Yeah.
Or wherever to look for giants.
A vacation. Precisely how I would describe it.
Exactly. Misses half the year.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then he's taking care of
Grop.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Hire a gamekeeper, dude.
Yep. Yep. There we go.
Like, he doesn't need to keep doing it.
As we close out the chapter a little bit, we get another little moment.
Give him an office in the castle.
Jay's like, I can't.
Where was Professor Kettleburn working?
I don't know.
Exactly.
I don't know.
In the castle.
Yep.
He didn't have a hut on the grounds.
Although, to be fair, in his line of work, he had been losing at least a number of limbs.
Well, I don't know how Dumbledore expects Hagrid to keep up with his gatekeeping duties and his limbs. His soon-to-be lessened number of limbs.
Yeah, yeah. There you go. Anyway, can we move past
it? He doesn't even have a wand.
We can't move past it. Okay, yeah, we're still there. How about now?
Now.
We're good. Okay, we've made it. We made it through the woods. All right. So, yeah, so as we're closing out the chapter, we get up to the Gryffindor Tower, where we get the first password for Prisoner of Azkaban, which is going to be Fortuna Major. So if anybody wants to quiz me about that when you see us later in September.
Ben will not remember.
I will probably not remember. I did translate it, which means the greater fortune, which is probably not hard to figure out.
Oh, there you go. The greater fortune.
Yep. Yeah. Neville says, oh no. He always had trouble remembering the passwords, which of course is like a little
setup for later.
Yep. Absolutely. He will have all the passwords written down, which he then leaves, which is what Sirius Black finds. So we can get into the Gryffindor common room. Mm-hmm. But then Harry makes his way up to the Gryffindor, or his dormitory rather, in the 5-4 poster beds. And it says, Harry, looking around, felt he was home at last.
Good for you, Harry.
I know.
I love that line. Ends on a nice little happy note there after running into a Dementor earlier that day.
I know. Yeah. So Harry making it through all the drudgery. That closes us out. Chapter 5 of Prisoner of Azkaban. I think it was a super fun chapter. It was a long chapter.
It was a long chapter. Yeah. Yes. Our longest one so far, anyway.
I know. Yeah. By the time we get into like Order of the Phoenix chapters, I feel like people are going to be like, "All right, I'm going to have to like say this is going to be a two-parter, maybe."
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not opposed to it if we get there. You know. Yeah. It could happen. Well,
one half of chapter 13 of Order of the Phoenix. People are like, "Okay, guys. Yeah. Man, we're really getting.
We're going to be. This is the Order of the Phoenix podcast at this point. You know. Yep.
Oh man. Well, before we start to tease chapter 6, Talons and Tea Leaves. Jay, do you have a review for us?
I do.
All right, lay it on me.
This review is from Bob 173949957.
Hey, yeah. you know the one.
You know him.
What if that is actually the number of Bobs that have existed in the world prior to this Bob?
Wow,
and that is their official Bob number.
That's their official Bob number. That'd be impressive, and a lot of people named Robert.
Yeah.
So there says, "Hey, brother, this podcast is great. I look forward to the start of every week, every time. Now this is awesome. I do have a theory, though. This is the question: Is Harry Voldemort? My question is: When Voldemort is making his Horcruxes, he split his soul." So the ring had the most soul in it, and at the end, Voldemort himself will have the least. So according to this theory, this means that Harry has more of Voldemort's soul in him than Voldemort himself. But that's just a theory, a Harry Potter theory.
Hey, all right, I see what you did there.
That's the thing.
That's like a game theory, film theory.
Yeah, yeah, game theory, film theory, food theory. Style theory?
Do they close all of them the same way?
They have all four, yeah. Oh, nice. Well, I don't know. I guess they probably do, but maybe not.
The point is we know the reference.
And also, this is I'm glad someone brought this up because this is one of like the most classic Harry Potter theory/misconceptions right. out there.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Yes. So it is definitely kind of interesting because the phrasing of splitting one's soul through the process of creating a Horcrux, it does almost seem like the first one he made would have taken half of his soul.
Right.
Meaning that the second one would take a quarter of his soul and then an eighth
and then a 16th and then a 32nd and yeah.
So on and so forth until you get to whatever is left of Voldemort Prime himself, which seems like scant amounts.
Right, scant amounts. And since Voldemort has split it, so based on the order in which he does things, he attacks Harry and splits his soul there unknowingly, and then after that splits it again in the making of Nagini.
Yes.
So the portion inside of Harry, if that math tracked, would be higher than the portion inside of Voldemort himself, meaning that Harry was actually more Voldemort than Voldemort.
Right.
So it's a fun theory. However, not exactly how the soul splitting works.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Explain. Yeah. Continue.
So basically the way it works is that despite the number of times you split it, it's not like you're like cutting an apple in half and then putting half an apple inside of the ring and then a quarter of an apple inside the diary. It's like every time he splits his soul, it just evens out across everything.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so like at the end, everything that exists has a 1/8 part soul.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
So that at least means Harry is equal parts Voldemort to Voldemort.
Yes. Harry is at all times equal parts Voldemort to Voldemort.
Okay.
Yes. So it's not like they then like grow in size or something like when the diary is destroyed. It's just then that there are only 7/8 amount of soul left.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's a very interesting and complicated aspect of the story for sure. But it's also kind of interesting as well, because I think like you tend to think that like each time it's making him like weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker. And in like, in terms of almost like part of his like power is being like stashed separate from his body. And I do think that there's sort of like a, like almost like video game aspect of like, you've destroyed 1/8 of Voldemort's soul. Keep going, destroy the other 7 pieces.
Right.
You know, and it's like, but I still think that Voldemort is extremely powerful, even with only 1/8 soul. It's more of like what we see inside of King's Cross Station that really demonstrates the weakness that he has like subjected himself to by that like kind of bizarre mangled remains.
Yes.
Of like whatever that odd, you know, baby looking bloodied
right. It's like,
is.
Yeah. It's like if you were looking at the real world through the lens of the afterlife, which is kind of what you're getting a glimpse of there. It's like Harry is still a whole complete person with his whole soul right there.
Yes.
And Voldemort is like the creepy baby thing on the floor that can barely walk. Like, as far as the afterlife is concerned, that's all that's left of him.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's that is not the piece of soul that was just destroyed. That is Voldemort.
Yeah. And so I think kind of like the sentiment there is that, like, you know, Dumbledore even says like, well, where are we? And Harry's like, well, we're in King's Cross Station. And like Dumbledore's like, are we really? Well, how about that? And it's like, well, you know, you say that's where we are. Then, you know, if you decided not to return, then you could say board a train and leave. And it's like, where would it take me? And the answer is on, you know, like the great beyond.
Where,
little soul.
Little soul reference.
You nailed it. Yeah.
Thank you.
I think in my mind, sort of the thought would be there is that like part of like what happens to Voldemort is that he is so weak in that capacity once he achieves that location that it's like, even if he could also perceive himself in King's Cross Station, he could never get himself to the train.
Right.
So it's like that is the horrific destiny to which Voldemort is subjected to by this horrific act that he has placed upon his soul.
Right.
Is that like he could maybe even see the exit and he will never be able to, like,
reach it
because he has left himself in that capacity.
Right. He's so mangled and maimed by the end.
So it's like, it's almost more speaking to how weak he is in death more than it is speaking to how weak he may have become in life.
Right.
Is what I'm attempting to explain.
Yes. Like in death, he is nothing, but in life, he is still quite powerful.
And I mean, that would be the really big question is like, is Voldemort less powerful than he was before his original downfall or before he made his Horcruxes? And I don't think he's less powerful.
Right, in terms of just like raw power,
ability to, I mean, because that's even like, you know, like what people are like, Snape, you know, says like, you've performed great magic with that. And it's like, Voldemort's like, no, I'm extraordinary. Like,
yes.
I can perform great magic, but this wand has not done anything to enhance that power.
Yeah.
I think Voldemort, even as he is still just as powerful as he always would be. But otherwise, then when it comes to the more important thing, as would argue the themes of the book, when it comes to his death, he's nothing.
Yes, but like, and then also as per the themes of the book, he doesn't even get to die properly. Like, all the other characters die, they get to go on and live in the afterlife.
Yes.
And Voldemort stuck in limbo forever.
Yeah, so what he feared was death. What he got was worse.
Was worse, yes. Yep. Yes, so... Yeah, there's not like, oh, at least he got to die, you know?
Yep.
Nope.
So, but great question, as per always. I know that's one that has certainly like flitted around a little bit before because the math is kind of odd and Horcrux logic is always a little confusing. So great question from Bob, whatever number Bob you are in the world, we appreciate it.
Yeah.
But I think that rounds us off.
I think it does on a somewhat extra long episode of Through the Gryffindor. But make sure you join us next time for Chapter 6, Talons and Tea Leaves, which I want to say is an even longer chapter here on Through the Gryffindor.
Today's episode was edited by Ethan Edgehill. Vaishon Brandon does our art. Catherine Stein is our production manager, and the show is hosted by me and Jonathan Carlin.